Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at axissacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program, Global Warming is Irreversible. Susan Solomon is an atmospheric chemist working for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Time magazine has named her one of the top 100 scientists of 2008. She says, quote, "People have imagined that if we stop emitting carbon dioxide, that the climate would go back to normal in 100 or 200 years. What we're showing here is that's not right. It's essentially an irreversible change that will last for more than 1,000 years, unquote. And finally, are the poor the cause of the economic crisis? Simon Johnson looks into the cause of the economic meltdown.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. There is some sobering news to report today from a new study on climate change. There is no going back. Climate change is essentially irreversible. The study says as carbon dioxide emissions rise, the world will be committed to more and more long-term environmental disruption. And the damage will persist even if and when emissions are brought under control. More now from NPR's Richard Harris.
Susan Solomon is one of the world's top climate scientists, and the more she studies global warming, the more it becomes evident to her that this is not just another pollution problem.
We're used to thinking about pollution problems as things that we can fix. You know, smog, we just cut back and everything will be better later, or haze, you know, it'll go away pretty quickly.
That's true for some of the gases that contribute to climate change, such as methane and nitrous oxide. But as Solomon and colleagues now show in a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it's not true for the most abundant greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide.
People have imagined that if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide, that the climate change would go back to normal in maybe 100 years, 200 years. What we're showing here is that's not right. It's essentially an irreversible change that will last for more than 1,000 years.
That's because right now, the oceans are soaking up a lot of the planet's excess heat and a lot of the carbon dioxide we're putting into the air. Even assuming we could stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that would not solve the problem. Carbon dioxide will eventually start coming out of the ocean, and the heat will come out too. And that will take place for many hundreds of years. Solomon is a scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Her new study looked at the consequences of this long-term effect in terms of sea level rise and drought. If we continue with business as usual for just a few more decades, she says those emissions could be enough to create permanent dust bowl conditions in the U.S. Southwest and around the Mediterranean.
The sea level rise is a much slower thing, so it will take a long time to happen, but we will lock into it based on the peak level of CO2 that we reach in this century.
The idea that changes will be irreversible has consequences for how we should deal with climate change. We can't turn down the global thermostat once it's been turned up, so scientists say we need to proceed with more caution right now. Michael Oppenheimer is at Princeton University.
These are all, by the way, changes that are starting to happen in at least a minor way already. So the question becomes, where do we stop it? When does all this become dangerous?
The answer is sooner rather than later. Scientists have been trying to advise politicians about finding an acceptable level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The new study suggests that it's even more important to aim low. If we overshoot, the damage can't be easily undone. Oppenheimer feels more urgency than ever now to deal with climate change, but he says in the end, setting acceptable limits for carbon dioxide is a judgment call.
That's really a political decision because there's more at issue than just the science. It's the issue of what the science says, plus what's feasible politically, plus what's reasonable economically to do.
Now, it might be tempting to throw up your hands at this point and say, forget it. If changes are irreversible and emissions are already running out of control, the situation is hopeless. But Susan Solomon doesn't see it that way at all.
I guess if it's irreversible, to me, it seems like all the more reason that you might want to do something about it, because committing to something that you can't back out of seems to me like a step that you'd want to take even more carefully than something that you thought you could reverse.
To her, that means stepping up action to prevent the situation from getting much worse than it is already. Richard Harris, NPR News.
That was Global Warming is Irreversible. And coming up next, are the poor the cause for the economic crisis?
Did the poor cause the crisis? By Simon Johnson. Read by OutLoudOpinion.com. The United States continues to be riven by heated debate about the causes of the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis. Is government to blame for what went wrong? And if so, in what sense? In December, the Republican minority on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC, weighed in with a preemptive dissenting narrative. According to this group, misguided government policies aimed at increasing home ownership among relatively poor people pushed too many into taking out subprime mortgages that they could not afford. This narrative has the potential to gain a great deal of support, particularly in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives and in the run-up to the 2012 presidential election. But while the FCIC Republicans write eloquently, do they have any evidence to back up their assertions? Are poor people in the U.S. responsible for causing the most severe global crisis in more than a generation? Not according to Darren Acemoglu of MIT, and a co-author of mine on other topics, who presented his findings at the American Finance Association's annual meeting in early January. Acemoglu breaks down the Republican narrative into three distinct questions. First, is there evidence that U.S. politicians responded to lower-income voters' preferences or desires? The evidence on this point is not as definitive as one might like, but what we have, for example, from the work of Princeton University's Larry Bartels, suggests that over the past 50 years, virtually the entire U.S. political elite has stopped sharing the preferences of low- or middle-income voters. The views of officeholders have moved much closer to those commonly found atop the income distribution. There are various theories regarding why this shift occurred. In our book, 13 Bankers, James Kwok and I emphasized a combination of the rising role of campaign contributions, the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, and most of all an ideological shift towards the view that finance is good, more finance is better, and unfettered finance is best. There is a clear corollary. The voices and interests of relatively poor people count for little in American politics. Acemoglu's assessment of recent research on lobbying is that parts of the private sector wanted financial rules to be relaxed, and worked hard and spent heavily to get this outcome. The impetus for a big subprime market came from within the private sector, innovation by giant mortgage lenders like Countrywide, Ameriquest, and many others, backed by the big investment banks. And to be blunt, it was some of Wall Street's biggest players, not over-leveraged homeowners, who received generous government bailouts in the aftermath of the crisis. Acemoglu next asks whether there is evidence that the income distribution in the U.S. worsened in the late 1990s, leading politicians to respond by loosening the reins on lending to people who were falling behind. Income in the U.S. has, in fact, become much more unequal over the past 40 years, but the timing doesn't fit this story at all. For example, from work that Acemoglu has done with David Otter, also at MIT, we know that incomes for the top 10% moved up sharply during the 1980s. Weekly earnings grew slowly for the bottom 50% and the bottom 10% at the time, but the slower ends of the income distribution actually did relatively well in the second half of the 1990s. So no one was struggling more than they had been in the run-up to the subprime madness, which came in the early 2000s. Using data from Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, Acemoglu also points out that the dynamics of the wage distribution for the top 1% of U.S. income earners look different. As Thomas Philippon and Ariel Reshef have suggested, this group's sharp increase in earning power appears more related to deregulation of finance and perhaps other sectors. In other words, the big winners from financial innovation of all kinds over the past three decades have not been the poor, or even the middle class, but the rich. People already highly paid. Finally, Acemoglu examines the role of federal government support for housing. To be sure, the U.S. has long provided subsidies to owner-occupied housing, mostly through the tax deduction for mortgage interest. But nothing about this subsidy explains the timing of the boom in housing and outlandish mortgage lending. The FCIC Republicans point the finger firmly at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other government-sponsored enterprises that supported housing loans by providing guarantees of various kinds. They are right that Fannie and Freddie were too big to fail, which enabled them to borrow more cheaply and take on more risk with too little equity funding to back up their exposure. But while Fannie and Freddie jumped into dubious mortgages, particularly those known as Alt-A, and did some work with subprime lenders, this was relatively small stuff and late in the cycle, e.g. 2004 to 2005. The main impetus for the boom came from the entire machinery of private label securitization, which was just that, private. In fact, as Acemoglu points out, the powerful private sector players consistently try to marginalize Fannie and Freddie and exclude them from rapidly expanding market segments. The FCIC Republicans are right to place the government at the center of what went wrong, but this was not a case of overregulating and overreaching. On the contrary, 30 years of financial deregulation, made possible by capturing the hearts and minds of regulators and of politicians on both sides of the aisle, gave a narrow private sector elite, mostly on Wall Street, almost all the upside of the housing boom. The downside was shoved onto the rest of society, particularly the relatively uneducated and underpaid, who now have lost their houses, their jobs, their hopes for their children, or all of the above. These people did not cause the crisis, but they are paying for it. Simon Johnson, a former chief economist of the IMF, is co-founder of a leading economics blog, BaselineScenario.com, a professor at MIT Sloan, and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. His book, 13 Bankers, co-authored with James Kwok, is now available in paperback.
I tell you, gentlemen, we have a problem on our hands.
Shock and awe are the intentions. Sounds like terrorism to me. And in fact, bombing is terrorism. War is terrorism.
And tonight I have a message for the brave and oppressed American people. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
In the past several weeks, your policy on Iran has generated opposition from the governments of France, Russia, China, Germany, Turkey, the Arab League, and many other countries over the risk of NATO invasion, and drawn millions of ordinary citizens around the world into the streets in a war for them. What went wrong?
In the Garden of Eden, baby.
Attack on military targets in Iraq.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United
United States military has begun strikes against our staunch friend, Great Britain. Australia, Germany, and France, more than 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and across Asia. These carefully targeted actions are designed to attack the Islamic faith. This military action is a part of our campaign against diplomacy, intelligence, freedom.
Today, the death rate of children under five is over 4,000 every month. That's 4,000 more than would have died before sanctions.
The Bush administration is transforming America for the worse. They're starving the necessities of our country in terms of budgets that are now being allocated to the war against Iraq and the military buildup. They are undermining our civil liberties, the critical pillar of our democracy, shilling political dissent and privacy, creating a nation of suspects, and above all, they're endangering this country by a reckless invasion of Iraq that many retired generals and admirals think pose no threat to the United States.
You're in the garden.
Who don't want to listen, who just go on TV and with belligerent sound bites talk to the American people. I think that has to become a near-term issue. This president is not hearing the other side from many people who have fought in our wars and who know and are much more experienced about these matters than both he and his chicken hawk advisors.
The same administration officials now advocating bombing of Iraq supported Saddam Hussein 20 years ago, knowing he was using chemical weapons even then.
In all of this discussion that goes on about inspections and weapons of mass destruction and the violation of UN resolutions, very little discussion of who's going to die in this war, who's going to be wounded in this war.
Just as the CIA predicted last year in a letter to Congress that if we invade Iraq, he's very likely to use chemical and biological weapons, the raw materials of which we sold him under the Reagan and Bush administration, under a Department of Commerce export license.
Government has said again and again, well, terrorists, they have cells in the 20 countries, 30 countries, 40 countries. They change the number all the time. The reason they change the number is they don't know. There's a lot they don't know, so they make it up.
And this is an incredible situation that we now are condemning this brutal dictator for doing in the 1980s what he did with chemical warfare based on materials we sold him before, during, and after he gassed these innocent people and the Iranian combatants.
You feel safer now as a result of safer now in Afghanistan.
You're bombing Afghanistan.
Shock and awe.
Sounds like terrorism to me.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll. Some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know where.